Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Welcome to Part 1 of the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. A Rosetta Stone is defined as a key to some previously undecipherable mystery. In his 1973 book titled November 22, 1963, You Are the Jury, David Bellin, assistant counsel to the Warren Commission and one of the chief defenders of the Warren Report, asserts that, quote, the Rosetta Stone to the solution of President Kennedy's murder is the murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit. Once it's admitted that Lee Harvey Oswald killed patrolman J.D. Tippit, there can be no doubt that the overall evidence shows that Oswald was the assassin of John F. Kennedy, end quote. While the Kennedy assassination has been an undecipherable mystery for the past 62 years, the Tippit murder will not unlock all the mysteries of the Kennedy assassination. The Tippit murder does, however, show that there were two men resembling Lee Harvey Oswald, two wallets, two sets of identification, two arrests in a Texas theater, and two murders, which resulted in one man, Lee Harvey Oswald, being charged with the murder of both J.D. Tippit and President John F. Kennedy. Oak Cliff is a neighborhood in Dallas bordering the Trinity River. It lies just a mile southwest of Dealey Plaza. According to the Warren Report, roughly 45 minutes after President John F. Kennedy's assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald fatally shot Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit near the intersection of 10th Street and Patton Avenue in Oak Cliff. I've always thought that it was weird that Oswald would go out of his way to bring attention to himself by murdering a police officer if he had just killed the president. Wouldn't he just want to lay low? According to the Warren Report, Lee Harvey Oswald encountered Officer J.D. Tippit in Oak Cliff and realized the officer recognized him as matching the suspect's description in President Kennedy's assassination. At that moment, fearing capture, Oswald allegedly made a faithful decision to shoot and kill Officer Tippit. But decades later, doubts still linger. Was Oswald truly Tippit's killer? In the episodes ahead, we'll dig into murky details surrounding that afternoon. We'll examine critical questions like, what did eyewitnesses say about the shooter? What exactly happened during the brief fatal encounter between Tippit and his killer? And perhaps most importantly, did anyone actually identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the gunman? What are the first-hand accounts from those who witnessed the moments surrounding Officer Tippit's death? What did they say? And how did their stories shape our understanding of that day? In today's episode, we're going to try and answer why Officer Tippit was patrolling Oak Cliff that day and why some of his movements that day are very confusing and add to the mystery of this event that changed American history. We're on a mission to find out, did Lee Harvey Oswald kill Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit? For decades, skeptics have scrutinized the circumstances surrounding Officer J.D. Tippit's death, zeroing in on a puzzling detail. What was Tippit doing in Oak Cliff at all? His presence there at the time of his fatal shooting has long seemed out of sync with standard police procedure, raising questions that still haven't been fully resolved.
8778 moving to Central Oak Cliff area.
Keith and Donahue. 87
The Warren Report asserts that at 12:45 p.m., a police dispatcher directed Unit 78, which was Officer J.D. Tippit, to move into the central Oak Cliff area. This claim is based on police radio logs submitted as evidence. But critics aren't convinced. Researcher Sylvia Meyer and others have cast serious doubt on the reliability of those logs, noting that no fewer than 3 separate transcripts were given to the commission, each with inconsistencies. Why 3 versions of the same transmission? And which, if any, reflects what truly happened? If Tippett was following direct orders, why the conflicting documentation? If he wasn't, then what led him to that neighborhood and into the path of a gunman on that November afternoon? The timeline gets murkier the deeper you dig. On December 3, 1963, the Dallas Police Department submitted its first set of police radio transcripts to the Warren Commission. Curiously, this version contained no mention of a 1245 dispatcher order instructing Officer J.D. Tippett to leave his assigned area and head into Oak Cliff. Months later, in April 1964, Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry gave testimony to the Warren Commission attempting to explain the submission. He claimed the order was excluded from the log because it was, quote, difficult to hear. Yet he also insisted he could hear it clearly enough to confirm the 1245 instruction had in fact been given. That claim has drawn scrutiny. If the audio was too poor to include in an official log, how could Curry be so sure what was said? Soon after Curry's appearance, the police produced a second transcript, this one listing only officer numbers, not names. It showed Unit 78, which was Tippett, and Unit 87, which was Officer R.C. Nelson, were ordered to Oak Cliff at 12:45 p.m. But questions only deepened with the arrival of a third transcript, this time prepared by the FBI in August 1964, using the original tape recordings. This version explicitly named Tippett and Nelson, documented the 12:45 dispatch, and even included their responses, acknowledging the instruction. But here's the wrinkle. Officer Nelson's movements tell a different story. According to police logs, Nelson didn't surface again until 1:30 p.m., and not in Oak Cliff, but at the Texas School Book Depository. There's no indication that dispatchers expected him elsewhere. No follow-ups, no corrections. In fact, an FBI summary blatantly states, quote, R.C. Nelson, dispatched to the Texas School Book Depository, were stationed in front of the building the remainder of that afternoon, end quote. That leaves an odd asymmetry. Only 2 officers were supposedly pulled from their standard patrols to enter Oak Cliff, while everyone else was sent downtown. One of those officers didn't go. The other, Officer J.D. Tippett, was killed within minutes in Oak Cliff. So what are we left with here? One man's word and a retroactive compiled FBI transcript? And a lingering question, was Tippett really dispatched to Oak Cliff? Or was history rewritten to make it seem that way?
8778 moving to Central Oak Cliff area.
According to the official narrative, Officer J.D. Tippett acknowledged a dispatcher's order at 12:45 p.m., stating over the police radio, quote, I'm at Kist and Bonneview, end quote. That confirmation placed him in the southern sector of Oak Cliff, but a cluster of eyewitness reports directly challenges that account. 5 individuals, interviewed not by the Warren Commission, but by investigative reporter William Turner for Ramparts magazine, claimed they saw J.D. Tippett between 12:45 and 1 p.m. at the Gloco gas station at 1502 North Zang Boulevard, nearly 2 miles from Kist and Bonneview. What makes these reports especially difficult to dismiss is the personal familiarity between Tippett and the witnesses. Al and Lou Volkland, a married couple, both knew Tippett and said he waved at them from his patrol car. Tom Mullins, Emmett Hollingshead, and J.B. Lewis, all employees at the Gloco station, also recognized him and offered consistent accounts. All 5 witnesses recalled Tippett parked in the lot, watching traffic coming over the Houston Street viaduct from downtown Dallas. They claim he remained there for about 10 minutes before suddenly speeding off down Lancaster, timing that cast serious doubts on the radio transmission attributed to at 12:45. This testimony not only contradicts the Warren Report's versions of events, but underscores a glaring procedural gap. None of these witnesses were ever interviewed by the Warren Commission. Why? The omission also raises a critical question. If Tippett was really at Kest and Bonneview, then how could he also be calmly posted at a gas station 2 miles away at the exact same time, witnessed by multiple people who personally knew him? Did Tippett lie to dispatch about his 12:45 location? And if so, why? Something doesn't add up here. According to the third police transcript, the only one that mentions it, Officer J.D. Tippett radioed in at 12:45 p.m., reporting his location at Kist and Bonneview. That intersection lies approximately 5.5 miles southeast of the Glucco gas station on North Zane Boulevard. In normal traffic, that's a 15-minute drive. But five independent witnesses, including people who personally knew J.D. Tippett, reported seeing him at the Glucco station between 12:45 and 1 p.m., sitting in his patrol car and watching traffic come from downtown. They say he remained there for around 10 minutes and then abruptly sped off towards Lancaster. This timeline poses an undeniable logistic contradiction. If Tippett was truly at Kist and Bonneview at 12:45, the earliest he could have arrived at Glucco gas station would have been 1 p.m. But by then, his 10-minute watch at Glucco gas station would have already been over. Conversely, if the witnesses are right and Tippett was at Glucco around 12:45, then he could not have been at Kist and Bonneview at that time. And here's the kicker. The only evidence placing Tippett at Kist and Bonneview is the third FBI transcript, not the original recording, not the first log, and not corroborated by any witnesses. Five people, including his friends and local employees, said that they saw him at Glucco. One revised document says otherwise. The math and the map simply don't support both claims. If Tippett truly wasn't where he said he was, if he wasn't at Kist and Bonneview at 12:45, but instead sitting quietly at the Glucco gas station observing traffic, then why misrepresent his location? Why watch traffic for 10 minutes and then suddenly speed away? Some researchers argue Tippett was waiting for Lee Harvey Oswald. Just across from the Glucco set a bus stop, the closest stop to Oswald's rooming house on Marcellus Avenue, and Oswald had indeed boarded the number 2 Marcellus bus after leaving the Texas School Book Depository before eventually abandoning it in favor of a taxi. For Tippett to be staking out that location, though, it would require more than coincidence. He would have needed prior knowledge of Oswald's route home, or at the very least, knowledge that Oswald had already boarded or was expected to board that bus. But where would Tippett have obtained that kind of information in such a short time, especially if Oswald's whereabouts weren't yet publicly known? Then comes Tippett's final radio communication at 12:54 p.m. He reports being at Lancaster and 8th, just over a mile from the Glucco station, and only a few blocks from where he would soon be fatally shot.
78. Down ahead.
You are in the Oak Cliff area, are you not?
Lines tonight.
You will be at large for an emergency that comes in.
If the witness's timeline is accurate, and Tippett left Glucco near 12:50, then arriving at Lancaster and 8th by 12:54 is plausible. But if he lingered at Glucco any longer, it's hard to see how he made it there in time. At exactly 1 p.m., the police dispatcher again called Tippett on the radio, this time receiving no response. That silence alone is conspicuous, especially given that Tippett had responded normally just 6 minutes earlier, 12:54, from Lancaster and 8th. At roughly the same moment, Tippett is spotted entering Top 10 Records, a music shop just a block west of the Texas Theater, or Oswald would soon be apprehended. Witness Louis Cortinas, who personally knew Tippett from his side job at Austin's Barbecue, said the officer appeared, quote, in a hurry, and, quote, upset or worried about something. Tippett asked to use the store phone, dialed a number, and let it ring 7 or 8 times before abruptly hanging up and leaving, once again in a hurry. Top 10 Records on Jefferson Boulevard sets about 1.5 miles north of 8th and Lancaster, and less than a mile from where Tippett was shot. If Tippett left Glucco around 12:50, stopped briefly at 8th and Lancaster at 12:54, and then continued north to Top 10 by 1, the timing works, but just barely. It's an extremely tight series of movements, especially considering the likely street traffic at that hour. Shortly after 1 p.m., the timeline of Officer J.D. Tippett's final movements grows even more erratic. According to insurance agent James Andrews, Tippett was seen just a few blocks north of Top 10 Records, behaving in an increasingly unhinged manner. Andrews was driving west on 10th Street when Tippett's police car cruiser came speeding up behind him and abruptly cut in front of his car, forcing him to halt. Tippett was reportedly agitated and visibly distressed, got out of his vehicle, and monitors for Andrews to remain stopped. Then, without explanation and never saying a word to Andrews, he ran back to Andrews' car and searched the area between the front and rear seats before hastily leaving the scene, Andrews described the officer's demeanor as wild and upset. Andrews was perplexed by this strange behavior and looked at the officer's nameplate, which read Tippett. We know Tippett was wearing his name badge on November 22, 1963. This is documented in a list of personal effects removed from his body at the time of his death. Why did Tippett choose Andrews' car to stop? Why didn't he pull over Andrews' car using conventional police procedure by using red lights and a siren and stopping to the rear of Andrews' car? Why did Tippett cut off Andrews' car the way he did? The act of cutting off another car and conducting a spontaneous search suggests he believes someone or something might be inside. Was Tippett acting on new urgent information? This would explain both the sudden phone call at Top 10 Records and this erratic vehicle stop. Why didn't Tippett speak to Andrews or give him any explanation for what was going on? Why was Tippett so upset and acting the way he did? If these questions could be answered, it would be very helpful in determining what was going on in the last few minutes of Tippett's life. Exactly where Tippett went and for how long after his sighting at the record shop and after his encounter with James Andrews are still unknown. Taken with the earlier Glucko sighting, the cryptic phone call, and the 1245 radio check-in, this encounter paints Tippett not as a man on routine patrol, but as someone under strain, following leads, and possibly piecing together his own fragment of an unfolding chaos in real time. So to recap, what was Tippett doing and who was he after? At 12:45 p.m., Officer J.D. Tippett falsely reported that he was at Keston Bonneview, a location far southeast of where five witnesses actually saw him, or the FBI fabricated the radio transcript that includes his statement. The latter would imply a coordinated cover-up for no clear motive, making the simpler and more plausible explanation that Tippett himself was lying. But that raises the bigger question, why would he lie? At 12:45 to 12:50, Tippett is observed by multiple people parked at the Glucko gas station, fixated on cars coming over the Houston Street Viaduct, as if he was waiting for one in particular. When that car doesn't materialize, Tippett speeds away, clearly agitated. He's seen 10 minutes later at Top 10 Records, making a tense phone call that goes unanswered. He hangs up and leaves in a hurry. Just after 1 p.m., he erratically stops James Andrews, inspects the back seat of his car without explanation, then drives off in haste. Moments later, Tippett is shot dead, within blocks of where he made this mysterious stop. Folks, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out this isn't the behavior of a patrol officer responding passively to a vague description. It's the trail of someone actively hunting a specific target. Was he looking for Oswald? And if so, how would he know? At 12:45 p.m., Dallas police broadcast a generic suspect description. Quote, slender white male, about 30 years old, 5'10", 165 pounds, end quote.
Attention all squad. The suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30. Slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle.
That fits thousands of Dallas men. If Tippett really was searching for that profile, why not stop every third pedestrian? Why zero in on James Andrews, peering into the back seat with urgency and bypassing any kind of standard procedure? He never used his siren. He never radioed in the stop, and when he saw nothing, he said nothing. So either Tippett was improvising based on an internal hunch, possible but reckless, or he was acting on precise information, not shared with the rest of the Dallas police force. That would imply Tippett had unofficial intel, knew more than his colleagues, and was working off record in a way that put him directly in harm's way. Was he part of something deeper? Was the phone call an attempt to connect with someone involved or someone trying to stop him? Was Andrews' car a mistaken match, the one he was told to watch for? Even more damning, if Tippett had caught up with his intended target, would he have ever known what happened next? Next week on The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination, we take a look at the murder of Officer J.D. Tippett. What are the first-hand accounts from those who witnessed the moments surrounding Officer Tippett's death? What did eyewitnesses say about the shooter? What exactly happened during that brief fatal encounter between Tippett and his killer? And perhaps most importantly, did anyone actually identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the gunman? We'll see you next week. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.